Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a Union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? My daddy was a miner, and I'm a miner's son. He'll be with you, fellow workers, until this battle's won. Tell me, which side are you on? Which side are you on? Sing it! Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Oh, workers, can you stand it? Tell me how you can. Will you be a lousy scab, or will you be a man? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on? Which side are you on? Come all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
The voice and banjo of Pete Seeger, a folk singer who devoted his entire life to peace, justice, workers' rights, and the environment, died yesterday after being hospitalized for 6 days. He was 94 years old. I have my own fond memories of Pete Seeger. I was fortunate to share the stage with him once. At a fundraiser, as a matter of fact. And he came up to me and he said, you know, no matter where I go, I make sure I get my paper. He was referring to the paper I was editor-in-chief of, the City Sun. It turns out, of course, it's Pete Seeger and Toshi Seeger, his wife of 70 years, who died last year at the age of 91, were the first subscribers, the very first subscribers to the City Sun. And I remembered him in 1988, blocking traffic in Albany in support of Tawana Brawley. And for that, he was rewarded with 5 days in jail. So we will remember him. In fact, just last Monday, in commemoration of Dr. Martin Luther King Day, I used his music, a really wonderful favorite of mine called The Water Is Wide, to augment the speech by Dr. King that I played that day. Pete Seeger, very fondly remembered, I'm sure, all over the world. He gained a great reputation for standing on the right side of things. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, January the 28th. And of course, it's all about you and what's on your mind, as today, of course, is Open Forum. 888-874-4888. This is the time when you express your views and you bring to our attention things we may not even be aware of. And of course, you are free to opine on things that you agree with or disagree with, of course, with respect. We do this all the time, so it's no news to you that that's the way we, as I say, that's the way we roll here. So your calls. I'd ask you, though, to be as precise as possible so that we could accommodate as many calls as possible. All right? So we start off. It seems to be a tradition now. Harvey from Berkeley gets us started. Hello, Harvey.
Hi, Utrice. Well, thank you once again for your show today.
Thank you for calling in.
Okay. In the name of Pete Seeger, I'd like to talk about fracking in California. And, you know, we're having this terrible drought right here, and it's just going to get worse. And Gary was right about the produce and everything. Well, the problem is that fracking uses about 8 million gallons from one, excuse me, it uses from 1 to 8 million gallons of water, along with approximately 40,000 gallons of chemicals per frack, and up to 600 chemicals, many of them are toxic, are used in fracking fluids, including several known carcinogens. And the problem is that these highly pressurized liquids can start an earthquake by lubricating pre-existing faults that are located deep underground. This allows masses of rock to slide past each other, and both the U.S. Army and the U.S. Geological Service have concluded that the practice of injecting pressurized water into deep rock formations causes earthquakes. And because California is located on the Ring of Fire, we're always being warned about the big one, which is a megathrust earthquake like the one that was experienced over Japan. And it was 9 on the Richter scale, 0.9, and it brought the Fukushima nuclear plant down. Well, here in California, we have over 247 identified fault systems. But the truth is that there's just too many to count, and there's thousands of undiscovered collaterals. Collaterals are faults that branch off of major fault lines. And two recent devastating earthquakes, the 1987 Whittier earthquake and the 1994 Northridge earthquake, occurred along fault lines that were previously unknown. And around the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant, there's a confluence of 13 known fault systems. So this is just setting us up here. And so the big one could trigger a nuclear meltdown.
Thank you, Harvey. Caused by fracking. I'd ask you to do explain as concisely as you can what fracking is.
Fracking is the injection of liquids under extremely high pressure to crack the shale, to crack this hard rock formation and get at the natural gas underneath the rock formation. But unfortunately, that's where our freshwater aquifers are also located, and using the toxic fracking liquids could not only poison California's freshwater supply, but diminish it as well, because fracking uses, as I mentioned, 1 to 8 million gallons of water per frack. And the potential is just wrecking the whole California coast.
But we have to move on, so be as concise as you can.
Yes, just I'm calling for a moratorium on fracking in California, because it could trigger a nuclear meltdown at the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant.
Well, thank you so much, Harvey. You've been very consistent on reporting on these environmental issues, especially on fracking. Thanks so much for calling in today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We go next to Baltimore. Green, you're on the air.
Trees.
Hello.
I hope you're feeling better.
I'm hanging in. I'm hanging in.
Good. Oh, well, I want to apologize for the last time I spoke to you. I tried to interrupt you while you were speaking. I hate to hear other people do that, and I did it, and I want to apologize for it. But I was conscious of the time, and I wanted to say that, and Sarah, I believe, yes, Sarah did say it after I called, that before you look at a people, if you want to understand, you know, the character and nature of a people, you have to look at them before they've had contact with other groups. And I think that the societies that we built before colonization and the introduction of white supremacy, you know, were more humane than the societies that exist now. even in Africa. And in fact, the reason was, Sarah said, the reason there's so much strife in Africa now is because of white supremacy. Ms. Lee, I think sometimes we give other people too much importance, particularly white people. And I'm saying that because, you know, I may have a closed mind and maybe not, but if my children are facing starvation, then it's my job to make sure that they don't starve. And I'm responsible for that. And I can't wait to recruit people from other groups, people not of my family, to make sure my children don't starve. If someone appears, that's fine. But I have to be concerned with that because I am as much man as any other man on the planet. And I can take care of mine without waiting for someone else to do it for me or waiting for assistance from someone else. If assistance appears, again, that's fine. But the job is mine. So I'll end with that.
Well, I have to ask you a couple of questions.
Yes, ma'am.
When you say that you have to do these things, it's clear when one has responsibilities for others, you do have the pressure of responding appropriately to alleviate their pain or their distress. But also, we live in a society where even if you were to live, quote, among your own, unquote, there are some rules and that are set for how we behave, whether with each other or outside of the group. So how do you deal with the question of responding to the pressure to provide with the idea that it might not be within set rules and guidelines for how we behave?
Well, you once said on one of your programs that we are the most creative people on the planet. And having the great mind that God gave to all of us, and again, I'll say that because I said it once before on your show, genius, I believe, is average intelligence for African people. It may be extraordinary intelligence for other people, but it's just average for us. Now, I have a mind that allows me to be imaginative and creative, and if the laws of the society happen to be set up so that I can't do for my family, then those laws I don't need to, I feel free to ignore.
Okay. Well, let's see how people react to your view. Thank you so much for contributing today. Thank you, Green, from Baltimore. New Jersey's next. Robert, you're on the air. Hello, Robert? He's not there? Okay, then Ohio. Rick, you're on the air.
Hello, yes. Yes, it's what the previous caller said.
Yes.
I think humanity requires a collective to survive. And so you know, the take of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and all of this is impossible, you know. And so we have to do it together. That's the only way it's going to work.
Well, here's the dynamic. In the United States, I mean, I appreciate your point of view. In the United States, we do live in an apartheid state. I mean, it may have a softer edge for public relations purposes, but the fact is, and everything points to it, that we have not emerged from this racially bifurcated country and the supporting philosophy of it. That people,
there's a reason for that.
I'm sorry?
The issue, I had something else to say, but the issue of race?
Yes.
There's a reason for that.
Of course there's a reason. And the reason has to do with one group deciding that they will dominate all others. That's not just unique to the United States. It's in every country that has experienced colonial rule or imperial rule, or even democratic rule. We still have this notion, it's a universal notion, one group of people dominating all others. It's everywhere in the world, everywhere.
Would you say it doesn't work?
When you say work, it means that, I hope you don't mean it doesn't work to the advantage of the people who are dominant. It, of course, works for them because they also have the support systems that they create. In the law, quote unquote, the law, as in the United States, we have the law. We have wrongdoing in the law from the local sheriff in the South to the U.S. Supreme Court with these atrocious decisions purely based on race. So all societies have some measure of this.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, I would – I'm sort of philosophical about the whole thing of race. I don't think you can technically prove race. And that kind of has a lot to do with what I wanted to continue with. I think of religion, Eastern religion, Christianity, mm-hmm. and Buddhism, all of this Judaism. I think that, you know, many tenets of Eastern religion, when sought after, splinters society or labor as requisite for looting resources. That's what it's about. And so I'm reading a book right now. This is my point. It was copywritten the year I was born, 1961. In the beginning of the book, it is rigorously naive, almost to the point of being offensive. But within several pages, it completely flips. And so this person, one of her quotes sort of confirms what I've been thinking. And the quote is, "The practical expression of faith is force." And so I just wanted to hear, and the person, oddly, is Ayn Rand.
The person is, I missed your last word. The person is what?
Ayn Rand.
Oh, Ayn Rand.
Ayn Rand. Uh-huh. Yes. And so many people say that neocons praise her, but I think it is an adversarial praise. It is not an admiration. It can't be. Go ahead.
Finish your thought, please.
No, that's it. You know,
People are on different journeys toward discovering the meaning of life, and there are all kinds of ways to get there. Ayn Rand, of course, was part of a movement at one point in the United States that kind of grew out of also a political philosophy. I'm not so sure that I understand it, although it is always posed as this very complex journey. I kind of differ with that. But
have you read her?
The issue with Ayn Rand and others, they're all searching for meaning in their lives, but they start from a point of view just the same without recognizing their privileged status. So they don't start on the journey to self from the point of view, say, that an unemployed person would, or that a person who has lived almost all or all of his or her life in an inferior status in any society. You have to take into consideration that grouping, these were artists and people who had they came from a well-to-do status in life, and the search for meaning didn't necessarily relate to the average suffering person's search for meaning. So I understand I look at it from that perspective. They were privileged members of society. They were largely educated people. They were almost all of them white. In the case of Ayn Rand, she was from Eastern Europe. Not Eastern Europe, but European. So there were all kinds of sociological influences in the way people conceptualized their search based on a reality that sometimes they didn't even acknowledge. And if you see that kind of a search in anything other than, again, perspective, I'm always talking about the need to understand environments for things. What is the environment of her thinking process? And the environment is as one who came from a point of view of privilege. She was a privileged person.
Let me say this.
But, okay, because we have to hurry.
She doesn't side with privilege in her speech.
She doesn't have to. That my point is, she doesn't have to. It is nonetheless, if you look at her search for meaning and in life, you can't disconnect it from her privileged position in life. You just can't. And so I understand and appreciate it, but I also appreciate it as the search by a person occupying, who was able, by the way, to go back and forth on this question. So she occupies a position in life that affords her the ability to look at life from a particular vantage point. It's not necessarily a universal vantage point at all. Thanks so much for calling, Rick.
Sure.
Robert, are you back with us?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
You're on the air.
As unfortunately, I put the footage away and I was listening on the computer and missed it. But in any case, we started off the conversation in terms of, or at least at this day and time, there are phenomenons happening weather-wise. And that was my concern today. Not just this day, there's some other things, but predominantly that. We have technology where we're able to actually study climatical conditions. To what great extent we can influence those conditions is not a perception of the average person. And Dr. Begat wrote a book on Angels Don't Play This Harp Anymore. He showed that our scientists were able to actually influence the jet stream. Now, we've been having extreme weather modification here, and I know people say, oh, it's global warming. And I'm not saying that it's not, because it is man-made. But my concern is that I watch on a daily basis these airplanes fly by, and they're putting these chemicals up in the air. And I'm wondering what, if any, does that have an effect? I don't hear it on the news. I don't hear it talked about on most of the shows. Gary will mention it every now and then. Some others will point to it. But we don't look into it because we have this mindset, I believe, that says, or my hallucination is that somewhere down the line that the people that are in position are forthright and they're going to do the right thing. And then we'll say they're not doing the right thing. But yet we'll sit back and not even question their motives and on what's happening in our world and what's happening around our world. They're trying to take away our ability to sustain ourselves by taking away pensions, by taking away your ability to work and receive some type of compensation for your efforts or for your work. They're taking away all the educational supports that were there. They're taking away everything that you can possibly imagine at this time, and we're still thinking that, you know, it's going to be a great world. Not with the present mindset that are in there. And I know that you talk about some of those issues, but I think climate, which is controlling of our food supply, if we don't get a handle on at least addressing these people that are in these positions and coming forth at them with some questions and concerns that we had, bigger than the ones that we're doing. I'm afraid that more catastrophe is down the line, bigger than what we can imagine at this particular point, because when you control our food supply, when you control our breathing of our air, there was a conversation that I had with a gentleman. He said, well, food is most important. I said, yeah, that's true. I said, but if you got choked right now, which you want, food, you want air. I said, the quality of your air is very important. It's the sustainability of life. It's not generally your food. There's people that go days without consumption, and yet they don't perish. They may be a little lacking something, and the body goes through something, but you can't resist without air, you know. And so I think that we're not looking in this area because it's very important. Without that quality of air, without the response to our world and the balance of our world, and I don't believe that enough attention is at least pointed in that direction that helps us out. So I appreciate the open forum, and I appreciate the time that you gave for me to at least express.
Thank you, and you did so quite well. Thank you, Robert, for your call today and for planting that idea in our heads. Thanks so much. From Los Angeles, DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrecht. How are you?
Hello. Fine, thank you.
Good. I think we're all over the place today. By the way, I've enjoyed the callers who called in, but we need to try to connect some of these issues, I think. I called in last week, and I was talking about the Moral Mondays down in North Carolina.
Right.
And it just seems to me that when we get a movement started, first of all, not enough people come out or participate or even support. Then it seems that we, quote-unquote, well, not me, but they end up falling for the okey-doke. And the point I was trying to make last week was that they just start thinking some of this stuff through. I'm sitting in a state right now that I believe has been in drought for 9 months. We reelected Governor Brown in this state. You probably know about that. And since he's been in, I mean, he's endorsed some of the weirdest things. Like, he's supposed to be a progressive the way he was running, but he's in favor of fracking. In a state where we're going through a drought, you know, 90% of the counties are in drought status of some sort. Mm-hmm. And he endorses using water in this willy-nilly way of fracking, you know, and of course injecting all those unknown chemicals into the ground. So if we knew he was in support of that, would we really have elected him? I don't know, but it seems that everybody's using this Obama model. I call it the Obama model. You run as if you're some sort of progressive or even a socialist in some cases, and then once you get in, you change around and start supporting all the nonsense that we need to get rid of. And I think we have to be more selective and smarter and more astute if we're going to vote for people. I mean, same thing with de Blasio in New York. You guys elected him, and now he's trying to bring back this idiot Bratton, who introduced stop and frisk to New York. I mean, so, and the same thing overseas. Like, I made a point about the revolution in Egypt. Same thing. I mean, these guys, the guy, Mohammed Morsi, ran his Muslim Brotherhood. He's supposed to be doing things differently, but then they had to throw him out because he was trying to endorse some of the same policies. And now they're back to square one. So we have to be smarter and more astute and look at these things more carefully if we're going to get anywhere through the system as it exists. You understand what I'm saying?
Sure. No argument from me. Your point is well taken.
So what I mean by, you know, connecting these issues, too, is like people have called in today and, went over the fracking issue. And then we went through the situation with black issues and things like that. Well, you know, these issues are kind of connected. And we need to kind of see the connection. And like, you know that, you know, I've called in before and you've heard me say that I believe that all resistance is local because the powers that be have totally corrupted, debased, or whatever you want to call it, the major systems that are in place, like the political system national, is totally corrupt. Congress, I mean, it's just the courts, like you said, the Supreme Court. Everything national is corrupted, and it's all controlled. So I believe the only resistance we have is local by, you know, people. I've heard some pretty smart people call into your show who could run for office, for instance. You know, I mean, in their local towns for the city council or whatever. And I would encourage them to do that. I'm thinking about doing that myself. So we need to get some progressive people to take some action, you know?
That's it. The idea is to activate, not just talk, to make
right.
real your – yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for calling.
Right. Thanks you. For, bye-bye.
Thank you for contributing today. We'll take this break and come back right after that. A little bit more of Pete Seeger. These are some of my favorites. They're also some of the most popular songs in which he encouraged the audience to sing along.
15 years ago, Lee Hayes and I wrote a song, and we never expected it would be widely sung, perhaps me and a few more. But lo and behold, 2 years ago, a young rock and roller made a record of it. The song is all around the world now. Now, the interesting thing is that there's not only two ways of singing this song, there's about five or six different ways. But I've found that they nearly all harmonize with each other. Now, there's a moral here somewhere. It means that you can sing it the way I wrote it, or you sing it the way somebody else changed it, or the way somebody else changed it. And they all harmonize together. If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning.
Hammer in the evening.
Hammer in the evening.
Over.
Hammer
out danger.
Danger.
Hammer out the woman.
Hammer out
the love.
Hammer out the
love.
My brothers and my sisters.
If I had a bell.
Seeger's If I Had a Hammer. Your calls at 888-874-4888. Just to remind you, of course, tonight is the great State of the Union address. You would want to take a look at it, and we'll be discussing that somewhere afterwards. But see how chastened our president will be tonight. From New York, Lincoln, you're on the air.
Hey, you chief, long time.
Hello, Lincoln. How you doing?
I had a couple of things in mind, but after listening to a couple of people, I just thought I'd elaborate on a couple of things. Oh, yeah. The last caller, in reference to the phrase he coined, a bummer kind of thing, it was really beautiful. You know, I remember when Galloway was once on WBAI, when he had a program. Hello?
Yes, I'm listening to you.
I called in, and I was pointing out, you know, a lot of the disagreements I had with Obama. And I suspected him before he even became president, because I listened to his debate keenly. And I realized that he was really duping the people. Anyway, I pointed out to Galloway all the lies Obama told to win the election. And Galloway's response to me was this. He said, what, do you expect him to tell the truth when he's running for an election? And that blew me away, especially because of who Galloway said he was. And this is something he said to me on the air. If you go in the archives, you'll see. Now, he actually said that, and I said, wow. How could this man, who, you know, so many people in England supported, say something like that? You know? I also liked your comment on, you know, the fellow previous to that, too. You know, because a lot of people, you know, they develop these notions of, you are responsible for what happened to you in this world. And like you said, the people who started those thoughts, those philosophies, are privileged people who, after they went to India or someplace, and they come back and they tell people that, and then now the poor people who are following them start parroting them like that is true. You know, and everywhere you turn, these people are telling you, yeah, it's your fault, you know, because you chose your mother and you chose your father, you know, in a previous life. Oh, by the way, I was happy to hear that Pete Seeger supported Tawana Brawley, and I still talk about you and Maddox for doing that, and I think you all should somehow try to bring that alive again, because it's sad that Pagonis and his cohorts got away with that, you know?
No, he didn't, actually. And I mean, you need to go to the archives. I can't remember the date of that program off the top of my head, but we had an update in which a Virginia court threw out Stephen Pagonis' application to basically be rewarded for defamation. But the court found that he had no standing just throughout the case, throughout his petition.
And I'll call back another time, but just to tell you this, I'm still in love with you, and I still miss you on WBI. I really think that you, what I did like about your way of doing radio when you were on WBI, it gave people this incentive to go out and do something about your journalism. It wasn't just journalism for sitting around and pretending that we're intellectuals, but something that gave you an inspiration to say, let's go out and do something. The last time I saw you was one of those West Indian parade. I came over, but you were busy. Anyway, I'll call you again, all right?
Thank you, Lincoln. Good to hear
all right,
from you.
Bye.
After all,
love you still.
Time. Thanks. Thank you, Lincoln. Thanks so much. That's an old fan of the old WBAI program I used to do called Talkback. 888-874-4888. It's really incredible when you link up with people who you've lost touch with for so long, and then just the voice and the tone of voice, you go, oh, of course I remember that voice. I remember it very well. On my Gmail email, here's a note that says, we have to punish both the Democratic and Republican parties by not voting for them anymore. The French aristocracy would be very proud of the American government today, as it has managed to totally ignore the average citizen in all the economic decisions the government makes, and makes the peasants unaware or anesthetized by their disgust with each other to the point that they have no idea of what is really going on. That from Nathaniel. You know, our relationship to the system of government is itself a huge body of study. And I've talked about this before here, that you can measure the relationship we have in just five areas, and you'd see that in none of these areas do we have any symbiotic relationship with government. Government dominates. It controls. It is all powerful over the citizens. And there's a need to recalibrate that arrangement, it seems to me, by people taking more responsibility. Voting is not the be-all and end-all of anything. Voting is just one way in which we are convinced by the same government that we shouldn't be opposing that we're doing the right thing. You're voting for selected people. The power of election and the power of selection, two different things. When people are asked to go to the polls and vote, they actually are voting for people who have been selected from the respective parties to be presented to the public for election. So you see how the process is corrupted from the very beginning. New York, Ali, you're on the air.
Hi, Latrice, how you doing?
Fine, thank you, Ali.
Okay, I have to apologize to you and whoever was listening the other day because I gave the wrong name and I made reference to the Supreme Court, and I was referring to Clarence Thomas, and I know I used the wrong name. But I do have a comment. Last Friday, I think it was Friday, you were making some reference about Detroit and
yes.
How some of these black and Latino major cities are being attacked, and how these people, they might be losing about, especially in Detroit, their pensions and all that. But mm-hmm. I was thinking about what you were saying, because I know a point of view that I have is that I don't know how people, they're going to be able, and I'm not even mentioning about the native, because remember, the native is almost as they even forgotten. They
yes.
just out there, and they're not even being mentioned. So now we're only mentioning about black and Latinos. But one of the things that it came out last year was that the net worth of a white family was at $124,000, and the net worth of a Latino and black was less than $7,000. How are we expect to rise up and do better in this country? And one thing that you talk about all the time is racism. How it's so deep in this country. And just that you mentioned that all these different major cities, including New York, because you had to come here and see. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you still live in New York or not, but mm-hmm. what is happening here. I mean, you mm-hmm. go to Harlem, and this is just incredible, unbelievable what's going on. So my question is, how are people going to do better when we've been put down and almost genocide in this country? I just don't see how people could really get up and do things. And that gentleman who just called before, and he was talking about that the election, you have to vote in your local election, and you have to resist in your, you know, for youth resistance. The fact of the matter that when Mayor Bloomberg was running for his third term, the main people
term.
Who supported him, they were people of color. You have to see mm-hmm. on TV the people that were supporting him.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the kind of things that I don't know what to say. It's just like I'm stunned. And like I say, the native have been forgotten. These people, they have been put out there, and they're not even being mentioned. And this is what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you. You've said it very well, Ali. Thank you so much for that. Just so you know, tomorrow is a very special presentation on Detroit. I urge you to not miss it and to encourage others to listen. It's going to be quite a presentation tomorrow. From Maryland, Madhu, you're on the air.
Hello, Yatrice.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Good. I hope you are,
okay.
too.
Okay. Yes, I enjoyed your show Friday also when you did the analysis on the political situation.
Thank you.
Okay, I wanted to comment on a couple of things that I heard.
brother DX from California was saying that we need to deal with politics locally. You know, from what I've been observing, and I try to keep up with what's going on, I have an example. I live near Washington, D.C. Now, Washington, D.C. is supposed to be a very liberal type of environment compared to some other places in America. But, and it kind of ties into what everybody is saying about what the last lady just said also. Now, if you look at the elected officials, they're all elected by the people, the local people. Okay, and if you look at the housing situation, public housing, people that live in public housing are literally crying because public housing in some areas, especially the Anacostia section of Washington, D.C., which is being sort of redeveloped slowly. And this complex is owned by the government, but when it's redeveloped, it's not being redeveloped for the existing citizens. And with the existing politicians that are supposed to be progressive and everything, they seem to have no ability to affect what happens in their own district. And, I mean, to talk about, you know, politics being local, it seems like regardless of what the people do, they get the same results over and over. So it's very puzzling. And if you look at the schools, I mean, if you have schools that are supposed to be not utilized properly, so the school, you have many schools that are being closed. Okay, if you do the math, if schools are closed, so that means that you don't have resources going to those schools that you closed. So that means that the remaining schools should be super schools. They shouldn't have to be hurting for any kind of resources, but it doesn't happen. There are still complaints about schools not having resources. So what happens? I mean, what's supposed to be the result when you close a school? Zero. That's what the people are getting. And I don't understand it. You know, we're told, well, you know, politics is local. The results are not changing. And that's why people get frustrated when it comes down to voting. Because we're supposed to be voting for progressive people. But well, we're not getting progressive results.
But you have to understand, too, that, and I just talked about it, these are you elected, selected people. Okay, you elected people who have been selected by their party structure. That means they are part of the party. Now, it's a rare thing that people have, you know, homegrown, community-grown, organic leadership. And we have to start doing that, get your own leadership. But before that happens, because it will take some time, if people understood actually this is a war. There's no other term. There's no need to be nice about it. A war is being fought against the people. But the people insist on not acting like soldiers. This is a battle. So when a school closes and people don't show up and they don't fiercely go to bat for their children and they don't fiercely express their outrage and they don't take this on as an act of war and respond like soldiers, then the system says, well, we could get away with just about anything. How could it possibly be the case that you shut down a school? I mean, even in slavery days, the first thing that African Americans did was establish schools. That's how important education was. And they began that process, like Morehouse started in the basement of a church. That's how fierce they were about education.
Absolutely.
But today we are so docile. We take these insults and, you know, we just shirk our responsibilities to respond like soldiers. This is a battle. This is a war. Deal with it on that level.
That's correct. You know, our ancestors developed universities, and today we're having problems even maintaining those universities that they created. We're not being asked to rebuild the universities brick by brick, but we can't even maintain what they built.
Well, somehow it would be important in your community and other communities that, even if you just start by talking about the problem and getting people reacclimated to the reality that they are actually living in, not the theoretical business, 5,000 schools are going to be closed by the end of this year across the nation. Almost all of them are in Black and Latino districts. And this president is still able to carry on as if nothing is happening. His Secretary of Education, like nothing is happening, because the fire isn't there from the parents and the communities that are distressed. They're not responding appropriately. So it would take a while to get that spirit back and for people to understand that there's a link between their condition and their lack of response. It has to happen.
Yes, I have a theory on that, but it would just take too much time, so I don't want to take up all the time.
Well, thank you so much for calling today. Very nice contribution today. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, we're getting close to the end of our program today. I want to urge you again tomorrow, a very special presentation explaining what's behind the forced bankruptcy of Detroit. And, of course, we do the presentation. Our guest will be talking in the spirit that we understand, and that is Detroit isn't just Detroit. Detroit is all over America, and we are connecting the dots. So please tune in tomorrow and encourage others to listen to this particular station. We'll end, of course, with Pete Seeger. Bless him, he has lived his life as a stand-up guy. That banjo of his did a heck of a lot more than many politicians in Congress and the state legislative level combined. So thank you. We salute him today, and he's in our memory. Stay tuned, and coming up next is Richard Wolff with Economic Update. And again, tomorrow, tune in. So we say goodbye the best way we know how today with Pete Seeger.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday. We'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand someday. Deep in my heart,
someday.
important verse is the one they wrote down in Montgomery, Alabama. They said, we are not afraid. And the young people taught everybody else a lesson. All the older people that had learned how to compromise and learned how to take it easy and be polite and get along and leave things as they were. The young people taught us all a lesson. We are